in verse 10.
John 10 and verse 10.
The thief does not come except to steal and to kill and to destroy, but I have come, this is what Jesus is saying, that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. Whoa. Sometimes, you know, on the surface, it seems like more abundantly. Things are kind of rough for a lot of folks right now. What's that about? Is that an inconsistency? How about Ephesians 3, verse 20? Ephesians 3. My wife made a comment, I guess, a week or two ago. I don't remember now, but all the different trials and tests and the like. And says, you know, it says in Daniel that Satan would, it says, pursue or persecute the church. And look, in the Hebrew, it means wear them out. You know, he just wears them out. And, you know, that kind of has a lot of emphasis there in our time. Ephesians 3 in verse 20. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, to him be glory in the church by Jesus Christ to all generations forever and ever. Well, you know, we believe that, but sometimes we're in the midst of a trial. Verse 20 sometimes hits a little shallow if we're honest with ourselves. Have you ever been there where sometimes you feel like, where's the abundant life? Now, not all the time, but I don't think you'd be human if you didn't sometimes ask, well, where is this abundant life? And then you say, well, I need to be thankful. I got a house, I got food, you know, I got friends, I have a church I can go to. I know things are not all bad. But boy, I'm kind of feeling it right now. And then here in the verse 20, to him who is able to do exceedingly above all that we ask or think. And sometimes you say, well, I've asked for this, and why am I seeing it? So we can feel pretty alone at those kinds of times and kind of abandoned. And again, hence it's important to have a fellowship, isn't it? Our people, brothers and sisters that we fellowship with, we get on the horn and say, you know, pray about this, pray about that for us and so forth. You know, it seems like at times some of these verses, we believe them, but sometimes they sound a little shallow. It seems like they come fall a little shallow. Well, what I'd like to do today is talk about grief. Because sometimes these scriptures seem to be shallow to us because we're in a state of grief. And we can grieve about all kinds of different things. Obviously, one we think about is a death in the family. And you can have a death of relationship. They're called divorces. You can have a death, another type of relationship, where children are cut off from their rest of their family due to you know, some kind of a falling away. You lose your job. You have health issues that you've prayed about, and it just seems like God is silent. You have financial issues. It seems like God is silent. You have you name it. Where is God in these times? And then we can start going through a sense of grief. We can go through a sense of grief. Now, what I want to do is specifically talk about is, if you will, a grief cycle. And why does God allow suffering? That's another subtitle to this sermon. But we'll talk about the cycle of grief. Or another title could be, why does God allow suffering in our lives? What can we learn from it? I think all of us are honest. We'd just rather forego the suffering part. Thank you very much. It's just not worth it. I see here somebody suffering right now. All right, let's go to Romans 8. And again, at times when it just seems like God has walked away from us, either personally or collectively, whatever we may be, especially personally, we go to these verses and we believe them, and we know they're true because they're in the Word. But boy, at times you can just say, how much more can I take? How much more can somebody else take, you know, this type of thing? Romans 8, verse 38. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels nor principalities nor powers, nor things present nor things to come, neither the height, the depth, or other created thing, shall be able to separate, put your name there, from the love of God, which is in Jesus Christ our Lord.
Here's a man who's shipwrecked, stoned numerous times, taken for dead, persecuted by his Jewish brethren, hated by many Gentiles, hated by, as I said, by his own Jewish brethren, hated by many portions of the church, believe it or not, off and on. And we've talked about that before. Corinth was one of them. You know, because I say portions of the church, generally the Jewish portion of the church. They saw him as one who's destroying their Jewishness, if you will. Anyway, this man had seen a lot of trial and test, probably a lot more severe than any of us have seen. And yet he says these things. So when I read that, I actually say, well, who wrote that? Well, I know it was Paul. And I go, okay, he's been there, done that, as they say, and got the T-shirt. He's been there. He knows what it's like. And so when he says that, I think we can say, if he can feel that way, so can I with prayer and with the right understanding. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, verse 38, nor angels nor principalities nor powers, nor things present nor things to come, nor height nor depth, no matter what, in other words, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Jesus Christ our Lord. And even in here, we'll talk about people who go through a grief cycle. Different things can happen. I know over the years I've had to learn in the ministry, even though you love the people and you care for them, you have to, and I think you see this in doctors, you have to separate yourself a little bit. I hope that doesn't sound cold. Or you go crazy. You worry about everybody and everything. And so one day when my wife saw me beating my head against the wall, she says, I think we need to talk, you know. Not quite that bad. But you have to learn to say, well, you know, I, there's only so much I can do. There's only so much anybody can do. And all you try to do is be the best you can as that physical instrument through which hopefully Christ can comfort those who are losing a loved one or whatever it may be. You just try to be that instrument. You can't fix it. And that takes a long time to learn that you can't fix it. But you can simply try to be that mouthpiece, the hands, and we do it very imperfectly, of course, through which Christ can be used to help. But you can't fix it. I think anybody in any people helping profession learns that. They have to, or they just can't stay in it. They just can't bear all the burdens. So, when Ward is in the hospital, I said, I don't care. Nah, I mean, he was in agony. He told Lori or some one of your kids. He's just here enjoying watching me be in pain, writhing in pain. I didn't know he knew. No. We just, you know, when you're at that moment, there's also a little bit of kidding. Even when he was in agony, he was still kind of kid with me, kid with the nurses. I said something that was really good line. I can't remember it now. But, you know, you try to get through it with a little bit of a smile, even though you're in misery. And he was. Believe me, he was. I'll let you privately say your comments about Facebook. I won't do that publicly. Okay. Well, what I'd like to do today is I'm going to quickly go over it. Then I'll give you a little handout. Then we'll kind of go over it together with some scriptures. The process of grieving. The process of grieving. And again, I just want to give it to you really, really fast. Let's go ahead and just read this here. First is the shock stage. Let's say if you've ever been in a hospital and you're waiting to find out if you have cancer, have you had a stroke, have you had a whatever. And I remember when my little adventure last year with my health, walk in, and everybody's, it's Bell's palsy, you know. I don't know who he is, but they don't sound too worried about Bell's palsy. So, okay. So then they did the little CT scan, and the doctor walks in with this look on his face, and he says, seems like to me you've had, according to this scan, you've had a stroke. So I unwisely called my wife at home and said, well, they think I had a stroke, because I just tend to be kind of go, which I shouldn't have said that, because then she came, and you can see the worry on her face and fighting back the tears. I go, well, that was really a dumb move. You know, I should have waited until she came there to do that. Okay. But, nonetheless, what happens when you first hear that? Well, the first thing it goes, for most people, you go, okay. That's kind of the first step. You just, oh, okay. And if you will, that's, you're sort of paralyzed by the bad news. Not that you don't care, it's just sort of, oh. You don't really know what to do. They're going to call that the paralyzed stage. And I'll show you in the Bible where that happens with some people here. So you work through that stage, and some people go through each one of these stages at different paces, at different times. It's like a cycle, if you will. It could be on a linear. We'll show you the linear style of it in a minute. And then other times, you may recycle at different times. It depends on your on the nature of the problem. When my wife miscarried, you know, I cycled through about twice through that process. My wife will cycle through it for years. It's a very different experience for a woman when you have a miscarriage. So you cycle through this type of thing. So you have this, they call it stability, or you're just sort of shocked. Oh, you have a stroke. Okay, when I first thought of it, I said, okay, if I have to choose a stroke, a brain tumor, or something else, I'd rather not have a tumor. Okay, stroke's not any fun, but okay, that'd be something. I was just sort of, then you start wondering about it. So, whatever it may be. If you indeed something is confirmed, whatever, and it could be the end of a marriage. It could be the end of a relationship. Okay, we're done. I am so glad to be rid of him or her. I'm just done. That's it. Whew. Okay? Or you may lose a mate to death. Oh, you know, at first it's kind of like you're just so tired and exhausted, you don't feel anything. You just don't feel anything. And that's kind of a survival tact that God's put in our minds, if you will. Then as time goes by, and it depends on the person and the circumstance and so forth, you go to the next stage of be denial. And trying to avoid the inevitable. You're in denial. It's a funny example of denial, and it's not a serious one, but maybe help you see it. Oh yeah, Brian's 30 years old today. So 30 years ago yesterday, Lisa was in labor. She was 13 hours and writhing in pain. I kind of enjoyed that experience again. And after 13 hours, she's dilated 3 centimeters. Was it centimeters? Centimeters. 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 That much. Well, she's exhausted. So she gets up out of bed after they examined her and they left. So it's just she and I. She gets up, she starts getting dressed. I said, what are you doing? She says, I'm not having this baby right now. I'm going to go home and relax. I said, no, you're not. You're going to get back in bed. She was in a kind of denial, wasn't she? A type of denial. Well, we can get into not denial as well, and we do. These are survival skills that we learn. Well, somebody has this or that disease. Well, maybe that's a misdiagnosis. That's one area, a way of denial. Maybe it could be, well, it's not as bad as they say. Or we're going to do this and that treatment, which is nothing wrong with doing that. And this or that treatment is going to make the difference. And maybe it will, maybe it won't. But all these things are just little examples of it. So then you go through that. You may go through it in a week. You may go through it in a month. You may go through it whatever it takes. Then you get into anger. You're just frustrated. And you're outpouring of a bottled up emotion. See, through all the first two stages, the emotions are under control. You're under control. You're under control. I'm really under control. What happened? I thought you were under control. It's like a volcano. It can't be held in. It has to come. It may come out in tears. It may come out throwing something at the wall. It may come out kicking the dog. But it's going to come out. Because it's all in there. And it's a process. It's an anger, a frustration. The next one would be a bargaining stage. Ever made a deal with God? If you do this for me, then I will blah, blah, blah. Okay, now I think I may have told you this deal. Again, just a humorous example, but it's a bargaining. I made a deal with God. Back when I was in the seminary, 1968, went home to visit my mother for Christmas. Sorry, I didn't know about that yet. And so the plane lands in Portland. Everything's fine. However, the mountains were snowed in. You know how that's like. Miles would know that. And I was going to take a bus over the mountain, and she'd pick me up in Bend or wherever it was. She couldn't get over No. She was going to come over and pick me up. And she couldn't get across because the mountain was all snowed in. So here I am, 16 years old, by myself, stranded. And so I don't remember all the details. All I remember is I ended up in a bad part of town. I got on a bus, ended up in a bad part of town. And you didn't want to be in that part of town, in Portland, that part of Portland at night, like 2 or 3 in the morning. And the policeman came over, and you can see I had my little guitar and my, this was the hippie days, and, my suitcase. And he says, when are you leaving? I said, well, I'm going to stay the night, and the next bus will be in the morning. He says, you can't stay here, because after such and such a time we go home, we can't guarantee your safety. Great. Well, he says, if you go down the street, there's a YMCA there, you get a room for like $2. Well, that's good, I can do that. So as I start towards the door, this other fellow, this man walks up to me and says, hey, that's really a nice guitar case you got. And I'm going, whoa, who is this? And why does he care? And just then, the two policemen just grab one arm and each of that guy and just hollow out and says, you shouldn't be here tonight, should you, Mr. Selzo? And I think, I am getting out of here. So I get out of there and get down to the luxury motel for $2 a night. As I walk in, want some guy there, I don't know who he is. Just as I got in the elevator and the door's closed, he runs in. And the door's shut. And I'm going, this is not good. So I did my crap. And he says, hey, let me help you get in your room. And you pay me $2 and I can get a room. Well, he's an alcoholic, most likely, this type of thing. So I'm scared. I'm only 16 years old. So the elevator opens up. I grab my stuff. And I had a death grip on my stuff. Nobody's going to get it. Especially the guitar. I mean, there are priorities in life. And so I got to the room, and as I unlocked the door, he came in. Now he's making me mad. So I came in the room, and I just took my hand. He wanted money, and I took my hand right in the middle of his chest, and I pushed him out, just pushed him out the door. And I says, no, you don't get... I said, I don't have any money. Lying out of my teeth. I had $100 in my pocket. And I shut the door. Long story short, I got on my knees as a good Catholic, and I said to God, if you get me out of this, I'll study your Bible every day. I guess he heard me. Okay, so, because, you know, it beats a rosary. So, anyway. So I was making a deal with God. I was bargaining with God because I was scared. And I was trying to survive to me, which was very dangerous. And did I sleep that night? I had the doors bolted, a chair up against the door to make sure the windows were locked. And I don't think I slept 10 minutes that night. So anyway, I made a deal with God. I bargained with Him. Okay, now, that's just a silly example, but it does, you can make a deal with God. Okay, your loved one's dying of some disease, and you make a deal with God. If you heal them, then I'll make sure I will this. See, and again, God understands this. He understands we go through this process. He's not looking down on us and condemning us for it. The next stage, and some people, they cycle through these things once or twice, or some areas of them two or three times. It depends. Next stage is depression. This is the final realization of the inevitable that's happening. I've got to go through this, and it's going to happen, and that's what we have to go through. The next one, the testing stage. You're seeking realistic solutions. Well, if this is going to happen, what realistically do I need to do now? Financially, we're bankrupt. I've got to file bankruptcy. I've gone through this whole cycle. I can't help it. I've done everything in the world to do it. My loved one's going to pass away from this or that ailment, or I'm going to pass away from this or that ailment. I've gone through this cycle. I've done everything I can to try and save this marriage. I've tried sand on my head 2 ways to Tuesday, and nothing has worked. I mean, you've gone through this cycle. And finally, you come to this what they call the acceptance stage. And now you're ready to go to the testing, then you go to the acceptance stage. Okay. So, what I'd like to do is, if I could have Mr. Abbott, you can't come up because you'll fall. Mr. Abbott, can you come without falling? You can hate me later. And just hand that out. If we need more, I've got more here. Yeah. Well, better if you go one for family at first. Miles, let Barb read it for you. It's big words. And then as you read, go through that, you'll see what I just mentioned to you in a linear scale. this whole process. And you think, well, what is this? What kind of sermon is this? Well, it really kind of puts in this area for us, in this manner, some very spiritual things. Now we'll go through some scriptures where you see some people in the scriptures going through this process. And I'll take a glass of water while he's doing that. Thank you very much. The one on the first page is the part that we already went over. If you need more, I have more. What I did was, is I ran it off where it was two pages. Then I figured out I could do the same thing on one page. But I have the one page down here, it gets too confusing. Okay, now if you turn to the book of Ruth, I think the book of Ruth shows this for us. Now the first handout that I was referring to, and just so proper credit is given, let me go back and find it here. The first scale that I spoke of, the emotional response scale, is from a book from Elizabeth Ross on a book called On Death and Dying. Okay. And so that, just keep the lawyers happy. Okay. And the next one is something was made in the church, so you don't need to do that. Let's go to Ruth 1. We'll go through this whole process here. You'll see it in a quick scale, where God uses our difficulties in a way that we so many times we don't understand. And it does. It is a matter of faith, isn't it? When a loved one passes away, and we wonder, well, where was God during that time? Why wouldn't God intervene? Or when we were facing this financial time, why didn't He provide more for us? And, you know, is God mad at me? Have I done something wrong? Many times, and sometimes you may have. Other times, no. God is working something else out. And it's the step in faith is, you don't know where you're going. You don't know what He has in mind for you. You don't know what the step you're taking today will lead to something else. But you're not aware of it right now. And so to you it may seem like, or to me it may seem like, I need this course of action now, or I'm going to lose everything. Or, you know, my wife, my job, my family, my whatever, my mate. You name it. We've been naming several different things. Can't God see how important this is? He knows it's important. And God hears my prayers, but there seems to be that silence. Or is God working something here? Let's take a look at this. We went through the first part here already that you have in the first page. Now the second page is from grief to ultimate victory. That part we'll be looking at from the scriptural perspective. It includes all of the things that we've talked about, but then it includes the spiritual side as well, which the first thing, the book that I mentioned to you by Elizabeth Ross, the book On Death and Dying. She doesn't get into the spiritual aspect, obviously. She does more the psychological aspect. So the second page there, we're going to look at the From Grief to Ultimate Victory. In many respects, and I don't have time to get into that, when Jesus, in His life, He forego all this because He had perfect faith and understanding. But let's go ahead and go to Ruth 1 now. Ruth, the first chapter. Now, start in verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. Do you think people prayed for the famine to break? Sure. Was this a great time for everybody in Israel? No. It says during the time of judges, every man did what was right in his own eyes and so forth. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in a country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi, and the name of his two sons was Mahlon and Chilion. The Euphrates of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then what happens? Let's go down to verse 5. Both the sons died. Do you think they prayed and asked God, whatever it was. I don't know what they died from. Was it quick or was it slow? I don't know, but they died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. So by verse 5, between 1 and 5, she loses both sons and her husband. Okay? That was found in verse 3. Eliakim and Naomi's husband died, and she was left, and her two sons. And then her two sons died. Now, in this culture, as it is to this day in the Middle East, most of the Middle East, a woman without a husband or without sons who can provide for her, she is had. There's no social nets. There's nothing there. You know, she either goes back to her father, or she goes back to her husband's father or brothers, somebody. Or if they couldn't do that, they went into prostitution, whatever else they could do to try to survive. There was nothing for them. It just wasn't provided. So now this woman, in short order, has lost her husband and her two sons and all means of support, really, at that point. Now let's go to verse 8. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, remember now, her daughter-in-law has lost her husband too, right? Go return each to your mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. She says, you've treated me well. Go back home. This has been a disaster in our life. Do you think she feels abandoned by God? See? The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband. So you go back to your home and their older brothers, or maybe your father's still alive. So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept. They're going through a hard, hard time. And these women probably wondered, where's the God of our husbands? What happened? They didn't seem to help us. And they said, surely we will return with you to your people. And Naomi turned back. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Why would she say that? I'll show you in a minute. She felt like she had been cursed by God. God was bitter towards her, she thought. Why do you want to go with me? I got a cloud all over me. It just rains on anybody around me. And there are still sons in my womb. Are there still sons in my room that they may be your husbands? In that culture, you could even wait for the next generation came along, but no, there isn't any there. Turn back, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. So I'm going to be a widow for the rest of my days. I'm not going to get married again. For I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons. You know, this isn't going to happen. Would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having a husband in all those years waiting for these babies to grow up? If I was even married and if I got pregnant and, you know, if. Don't bargain here. No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Whoa. Sounds to me like she is going through the shock. She's going through these various stages, and we'll see that in just a minute. She feels like God is against her. In a certain way, she's experienced the shock. Would you think? Her husband dies. She starts to recuperate from that. We don't have a time frame here. Was there a disease epidemic that went through? Was there a war? We don't know. Was it an accident that killed the husband? Or who knows? But anyway, the husband dies. And whatever time frame was, now the two sons die. And she's in shock and in a certain type of denial here. Was there paralysis and then depression? I think you need a little bit of depression here. And then weeping. She probably was overwhelmed with grief. Now let's go here. We've read that. Look at your chart here in the middle. It says prayer, Bible study, meditation, and fasting. That obviously is what she would need to do to survive this time. And the Bible doesn't say much about exactly what they did, but she does refer to God. And she feels like God has abandoned her. She feels like God has cursed her, if you will. Verse 13, for the Lord has gone out against me. He's out to get me. Now, is that true? No. But boy, when you are in the depths like she is, it feels like it. Well, I don't see this abundant life that he said, right? What happened to those promises? They asked it thousands of years ago like we do today. And God is not surprised when we do it. God is not surprised when we do it. He knows this is the process. In fact, he's designed us this way to go through this process. We need time to decompress, if you will, through these tragedies or these difficulties. And you just can't do it overnight. You just can't do it overnight. Look at verse 20 and 21 now. We see there already, but I want to show you again. Verse 20. But she said to them, talking to her daughters-in-law, "Do not call me Naomi." And Naomi means pleasant. Her name meant pleasant. "But call me Mara," which that means bitterness. Why did she say, "I'm going to change my name? For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly against me, is angry or irritated with me." Is that true? No. We'll see that. God was working something out through a series of circumstances. How involved was he in these circumstances for a wife to lose a husband and two sons? I would say he was involved in letting those obviously letting them happen. Was he involved more deeply than that? I suspect he was. But he definitely was using it. And what was he doing with this? Boy, at this time, this woman just feels abandoned by God. She says, "I just changed my name. Not to pleasant anymore, it's bitter. Because God is bitter towards me. And God has turned against me." It's what we've already read those things. God is against me. And sometimes when we go through a trial, we wonder, I guess God's against me. Because, boy, everybody else... Now, you know this isn't true, but when you're going through it, everybody else in church is doing okay. But boy, see, God just got a bullseye on me. And that's not true. And here, if you're sitting here and you don't have this pressing down on you now, you say, "Yeah, I know that's true." But if you're going through a real hard time right now, you say, "Yeah, he's got a bullseye on me. Not only that, he's got a scope on me, high-powered scope, and he's got the finger on the trigger, and all I got to do is just move once, and bam, he's going to get me." That's how she felt. But none of that was true. I think here, bitterness here, the term can convey the bitter taste in our mouths due to grief that we may be enduring. We often go through bitter experiences, but instead of becoming embittered, with God's help, you've heard those saying, you become better. Maybe a little cliche-ish, but you become better. And it's true. But boy, when you're in the midst of that fiery trial, you say, "How can I get out of this?" Is that not normal? Does God understand that? Yeah, that's why he's merciful and patient and kind. He's seen us, seen our forefathers for centuries go through this. Hebrews 12:15. So we're starting to see her go through this, the bitterness stage. She's gone through the event of her husband's death and then the event of her son's death. Then she's gone through the shock of it. The Bible doesn't talk much about the shock, but we see the results of it, where she's making the wrong conclusions that God is against her, and so forth. And that part of that denial is that she's in denial. God is against me. That is part of the denial process. But it is also a form of survival. Your faith is challenged. How do you deal with that challenge of faith? Remember when you were baptized, you went through the baptismal tank and you came out of it, you know, spiritually high, spiritually strong, and just inspired. And then now, X number of years later, here you are going through this deep, dark trial, and you wonder, where's God in all this? And that's a survival tactic. And then she begins to see this paralysis. We'll see this paralysis in her life. It's just, well, what do we do now? I guess I'll just go starve somewhere. You kind of see this in Job's experience too, but I'm not going to turn there. What did I say? Hebrews? I didn't get that far yet. Just a minute. Romans. Hebrews 12. You must already be there because I don't hear pages turning. Verse 15. Watch out for that bitterness. "Look carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness spring up, cause trouble, and by this many become defiled." Again, this is a normal process, but you can't let bitterness stay. You can't let it stay. Right now, to be frank, many in the church are going through a mourning process with all the business that's gone on in the church. And there's a lot of bitterness in the church. And it's a cancer that Satan's waiting to let grow. So everybody, if you struggle with that, you got to repent of that and not let that happen. Again, it can reside in the hearts of Christians, and it can. Because you go through a mourning process. All that's happened in the last year, you go through that mourning process too, don't you? It's the process that the church has gone through. But bitterness will only destroy you in the end. You can go through denial, no, I'm not bitter. If you knew this, if you knew that, blah, 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 blah. And I don't care if you're a pastor, if you're a deacon, if you're a dog catcher, whatever. Got to be careful with it. Let's go to Ruth 2 now. Back to Ruth. I'm trying to put my little Judges. One of those really small books, so it's easy to fly right past it here in just a second. Ruth 2. Ruth 2. Verse 1. Now there was a relative of Naomi's husband, again, here, a man of great wealth and family of Amalekite. His name was Boaz. So Ruth, the Moabitess, so what's happening now? She's passing through the paralysis stage. She's passed through the depression stage. Now you're seeing a very compressed way here in the sermon, and also through the book. We don't take us through great details here. You see the disorganization stage? She's worked through that disorganization stage. Have you ever been so depressed you just get up in the morning and it's just too much to get a cup of coffee? It's just too much to care. And you can't remember anything. You don't know what your name is. You don't know anybody else's. And you know what? If somebody calls on the phone, you're just not going to answer because you've just had enough. And if your mother-in-law calls or your father-in-law calls or your cousin calls or whatever, you're not going to answer the phone because you know you may go through the phone line and tear them up. Because you just have... You just get so disorganized. You can't remember anything. You don't know where you're at. You don't know what you're doing anymore. That's part of that process. The weeping. She went through the weeping process. She went through the anger. You really see that here. Where God has abandoned me, she said. But now, she's beginning to get into this testing stage that you see here in chapter 2. And she talks about her relative. Well, I wonder, let's see if God's doing something here. What did she do? She's going through the natural cycle here, but she's not getting stuck with it. Now, you can, as I said, repeat that cycle from time to time. Just off the top of my head, some illustrations. If you're a lady and you've had a miscarriage, you've gone through that, and you've kind of cycled through it once or twice, and you think you're okay, you're working through that, okay. And then a good friend of yours miscarriages. And sometimes, if you're not quite finished going through that cycle, what happens? You ladies know. You go right through it again. Okay? Are you wrong? No. Have you sinned? No. Is it lack of faith? No. Now, if you let the wrong process occur and you get angry and bitter towards God, now we're hitting into difficulty, but you're going through a healing process. So anyway, we're seeing now where we're kind of getting into the testing phase in chapter 2, verse 2. So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let us go to the field and glean heads of grain. Remember, the other daughter-in-law left, and so it's just she and Ruth. Before whose side I may find favor. And she said, go, my daughter. So they're starting to get up and do it a little bit now. They're out of that disconnect area. Then she left and went and gleaned the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field. Just happened. Did it just happen? No. God's working here, but you can't always see God working. You don't know what's going on. So many times we walk in faith. We don't know what God is doing through the process. So it came to part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech, her husband. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem to see and said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." So he was a man of God. And they answered him, "The Lord bless you." So the way they talked to each other, welcome and certain courtesies. Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Who's this young woman? Is this?" Now, he's a man. There's a beautiful young lady there, and he sees her. That's not so unusual, is it? All right. But also, do you think God maybe said, "Look at this young lady over there"? Now you can obey God in that matter. It's okay. But God's working. He doesn't know it. She doesn't know it yet. Now they're in the negotiation. The ladies are in negotiation or testing phase with God. Let's see if God's working something out here, whatever it may be. Maybe it just be we could be at Boaz's field and just live off the corners of the field that they had set up there. And if that's the case, that's fine. Not knowing what God had in mind. So Boaz, verse 5, said to the servant who's in charge of the reapers, "Who's this young lady?" Verse 6, so the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, "This is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab," and so forth and so on and so forth. So they get introduced to each other. And this whole process begins. And you know the story. Now let's, as I say, you know the story. In time's sake, we can't just go through every little detail here. They're testing God, and there's more testing. You remember she even sleeps by his feet at one point. That was more of a test. Remember she said, "Go and sleep by his feet," just a sign of respect and humility and so forth and so on. And then they begin to fall in love with each other. They care for one another, and they're close enough. They're related, but not so closely they can't become married and so forth. Now, God allowed the husband to die. God allowed the two sons to die. And God was working something. But boy, in those early stages, what on earth good could come from all this? They could have gotten bitter and resentful towards God and circumstances, and but they didn't. They struggled with it. They tried to deal with it. They went through this process. And then in chapter 3, we see they started through the cycle of acceptance, and they found some solutions to things. And then Boaz becomes more and more involved. And then we get now to chapter 4. In this culture, when a man died and they had no sons, they would go to the nearest male relative in the family, and then they would redeem the field to keep it in the family. That kept the wealth from just being disintegrated totally out of the family. But to do that, you'd have to, if you're going to redeem the man's fields, you've got to take his widow. And we'll see here, this wasn't quite what he had in mind. He wanted the fields, all right, because that would increase his wealth, but he didn't want the women, his two women, and so forth. Let's start in chapter 4. Well, chapter 4, verse 1. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. This is where they would do legal business, at the gate of the city. The elders would be there, and different business transactions and different things like this would go on there. And it would go on there at the gate in front of the community so that the whole community would witness what is going on. So they didn't have to have a lot of lawyers and this kind of stuff. So he went to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative to whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Come aside, friend, sit down here," and entering the negotiations. Now he's a good businessman. He knows what he's doing. So he came aside and sat down, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city. They're witnesses, see? Witnesses to what's going on. So this is a legal transaction. And said, "Sit down here," and they sat down. And he said to the close relative, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother." And then in verse 4, "And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back." And see, she was trying to survive, so she sold it. "Buy it back." And again, you could buy back the property, and also in the Jubilee year, it would all go back to the families. Anyway. "Buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. If you will redeem it," you've got to buy it back, "redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me, that I may know. See, he had, the real estate word is he had the right of first refusal, the other brother, not the other relative, he had the right of first refusal. He said, I want it. Boaz didn't. He said, okay, so we're going to enter a negotiation. If you're going to do it, you got to do it. You got to buy the land or I'm going to take it back. That I may know, for there is one who... let's start verse 4 again. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me. Sounds like he was hesitating to redeem it for a long time, this other fellow. That I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. So he's the only one that could get it secondly. And he said, oh, okay, I'll redeem it. I'll exercise my right of first refusal. Boaz said, okay, now if you're going to do that, he's done his homework, hasn't he? We'll see. On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabite, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name, see? You must buy it from the Ruth the Moabite, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead among his inheritance. And the close relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. It would get polluted, it's diluted. You redeem it, see? Redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. It would be a bad financial deal for him, put it short and sweet. And Boaz knew it. So he just says, oh, well, you want to redeem it? Okay, here's what you got to do. Here's what the fine print says. The guy said, I don't do that. You get it. God was working something here. What's the point of all this? And again, it starts off with a woman with her husband and her sons and her daughter-in-laws, and they're just moving down, you know, got in a moving van and came on out to a new area. Next thing you know, all the men and folk are dead, and the women are devastated. They go through this cycle, what we've talked about. And you see that as you go through the book of Ruth. Now what happens? They're in the recovery stage, reorganizing, and now a time of renewal for them. Now they're beginning to put it together. What happened here? Indeed, God was very much involved, but it wasn't evident to them at first. Let's see how that works out. Verse 7. Now this was the custom of former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm anything. One man took off his sandal and gave it to the other in front of everybody else. A legal transaction is taking place. And this was the confirmation in Israel. So they were saying, how do you know this actually happened? Well, we had 10 elders here. They all saw it. See, it's legal. Therefore, the close relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. So he took off his sandal. Well, I'm out of the deal here. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all of Elimelech's all that his property and all that was the two sons from the hand of Naomi. I bought it from her. See, she had to survive. So she had to sell those things. And once all those things were sold, now he's buying it back to keep it in the family. Moreover, Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through the inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from the position at the gate, and from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day. I'm buying the land. I'm also going to marry her. And in our culture, we go, well, doesn't she have any say? Yeah, she's happy about this. She loves the man. And she's wondering, how can I? Somebody else got the first right of refusal. How are you going to work this out? Boaz says, don't worry about it. He was a savvy businessman. But by now, I wonder if he didn't see God working here. And all the people who are at the gate and the elders, these are witnesses, verse 11, are our witnesses. The Lord made the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah. What were they saying? What they're saying, we agree, and they're making a public proclamation and saying, the Lord make the woman that you're about to marry, who is coming to your house, like Rachel and Leah. All these, you're going to have a lot of kids. It's like saying, well, good luck, and I hope you guys have a great marriage, and everything works out for you. Okay? The two who build the house of Israel. Well, we hope that you guys will build a wonderful house. It's a nice way of introducing this whole concept. But you know what? That's exactly what God is going to do in a big way that no one understood yet. And may you prosper in Ephrath and famous in Bethlehem. We just wish you the very best, in other words. May your house be like the house of Perez and Tamar, born to Judah because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. Amen. Who would be the offspring? David. And from whom would the Messiah come? From that line. God, centuries in advance, worked out through the death of a man and then these two other men, and left these women destitute. God worked out His plan in their lives. And for them, that plan was through you. And when you marry Boaz, through you would come the line of the Messiah. Now, they didn't get all that at that point, but you see here, you give that lineage. Verse 13 says, Boaz took Ruth and became his wife and went into her, and the Lord gave her conception and bore a son. Then they do all this stuff that you see in the Old Testament. Oh, so-and-so bore, so-and-so bore, so-and-so bore, so-and-so. But you get down to verse 22. Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. And what did David? David, through him, would come the Messiah. That's the whole point of this four chapters in Ruth. Not the only point, but it's the main point, is that God used what seemed to be an absolute disaster to work for the good. Now, you and I, when we go through a difficult trial and we come out of it, we look back and we say, yeah, now I see how that all worked out. Now, 6 months earlier, when you're going through it, you say, what are you learning from this? I don't know. That's normal. You're going to go through this process. And do you think that when Naomi and so forth, Ruth got married to Boaz, that they were a great renewal? Boy, now, I've gone through this tragedy in my life, but it has worked out, and look how God is blessing it. And then still they didn't get the whole story. Someday they will. They will. So the point here is that in the end, God brings us through. But again, as you go through this time, you have to go through prayer, Bible study, meditation, and fasting to keep your focus. And realize you're going through a process. And when you see the process, you know, again, you have an event, whatever that event may be. And then a period of shock. Then denial. Then paralysis. Then depression. Then disorganization, weeping. Goes through all these different things. It's good for you not to deny any one of those processes. I'm a good Christian. I don't get angry. Well, you're the only one I know. I'm a good Christian. I don't need to test God. Sure you do. Everybody does. It's just good. Okay, I'm not doing it with a bad attitude. I'm just a human. I'm going through a really rough time. And if I could bargain with God, let's give that a shot. And God's, you know, He's not going to, bolt of lightning will not come and strike you down. Because if that was the case, you'd see bolts of lightning all over the place. And all the chairs would be empty. See? He understands that. But the key thing for us to have that faith, to let Him walk us through the process. And we'll come through it on the other side. That's why many people in the world, they may understand intellectually, like that first chart. Oh, they can diagram it out. And it's correct. But if they don't see the spiritual side of it, they get stuck, and some people, that's why suicide becomes an issue in their life. They cannot see that it leads anywhere, except to just total hopelessness. But when we have that spiritual aspect, we know that God is taking us through a process. We don't know where. We don't know where it's going to end. We don't know what road we're going to get through to get to that process. But faith says, in the end, I'll be stronger. I'll be a better Christian. I'll be a better husband or wife. Father, I'll be a better individual, I'll be a better servant if I go through this process. And you've heard me say it before, and not resent the process. Naomi and Ruth, especially Naomi, really resented that process. Have you ever been through a trial you didn't like? Hello. Everybody has. And you resent it like the Dickens. And God says, I know. And you say, you know, I've really resented, and I may even resent God for it. I may resent everybody else for it. And then you repent of it. You say, Father, I resented you for this, that, or I resented so-and-so for this, that, and the other. And God says, I know. You're going through a process. But I knew if you kept your eyes on the goal, and you kept faith, that you would allow me to see you through this process. That's where we are different from the world. It's not like the rest of the world. That's why our little area, I say little again, has gone through a lot. I'm sorry about the church congregation, that's not only us. We've gone through a lot. You know, Pam's mom is sick, and Leo's sick. Just for attention's sake, Ward decided to get sick for a while. Then decided he didn't need the attention, so he's better now. And you just say, wait a minute. When does this stop? Well, some guy, the guys fall off roofs. I don't understand that one. But he can tell you things he's learning. Maybe he doesn't know where he's going with some of this stuff. But there's lessons. We all learn when we go through the process. Don't resent it. Sort of embrace it through the faith. As it says in the middle section there, I've got to get back to it. Prayer, fasting, meditation, fasting. In other words, faith. You go through it in faith. One day at a time. You learn to do it one day at a time. That's why, this is just another aspect of why God allows suffering. Other times, we've talked about other aspects of that. But this is just one aspect of that process. Okay. We'll conclude services now with another hymn and a closing song.